This is Tidings from Hazel Kahn. Today, my guest is Medea Benjamin, a woman I've admired for a long time for the intelligence and creativity of her activism and for the sheer volume, presence, and power of her work. Medea is co-founder of the peace group Code Pink and also of the international human rights organization Global Exchange. She's the author of the newly published book Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. A week before our interview, Medea had just returned from leading a protest delegation to Pakistan to express solidarity with the Pakistani people and to deliver a citizen's letter to the U.S. ambassador calling for an end to U.S. drone strikes. It's an honor to introduce Medea Benjamin to the WPKN audience. I asked her to start by telling us a little about her personal background.
I grew up in Shreveport on Long Island, and during the time I was growing up, I was influenced by two things that were happening. One is the Vietnam War, and the draft affected our school and my cohorts, and I saw my friends being sent off to war. And the other was racial tension. It was a white community where blacks started moving into the community, and it turned into a lot of confrontation that included within the school itself. And so I think issues of racial justice and war and peace affected me at an early age and have been strains that have been with me throughout my life.
And it was the nice Jewish girl bit, as you were described in your Wikipedia entry. Does being Jewish have anything to do as part of your background?
Well, I think so, in the sense that I was instilled with the idea that we should be doing things for other people, that this idea of tikkun olam, of healing the planet, there was always times at holiday seasons where we would make sure that we were doing things for those who were less fortunate. So I think that background also influenced my way of looking at the world.
Mm-hmm. So some of your activism is really, you know, very active in the sense that, you've been dragged out of Congress and other places. More recently, you were in Pakistan, not just now, this recent trip, but in 2007, and you were arrested there in Lahore and detained. I'm just wondering, and you know, you're generally, not generally, but often described in the press as a troublemaker. And I just wonder if this affects your, you know, affects your effectiveness, let's put it that way, or, you know, is that an additional dimension you have to deal with as an activist?
Well, I think there's a lot of people who are concerned about these issues and they spend most of their time writing about it or doing online kind of organizing, and that's fine, and I do that as well, but I don't think that gets us very far, that we have to really do more and put ourselves out more, and that includes organizing protests and rallies and going to places like Pakistan, or I've been to Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, Bahrain, all in the last couple of years, and places that are oftentimes very dangerous. But I think as peacemakers, we have to be willing to take risks. Certainly people who make war take risks, and that might be getting arrested at an Air Force base protesting drones or getting arrested at a congressional hearing. But I think when the traditional ways of affecting policy, like pressuring your elected official, don't work, then we've got to try more radical ways.
And you've just come back very recently. You're probably still jet-lagged, actually, from your Code Pink trip to Pakistan. So talk a little bit about the purpose of your trip, this recent one, and who the delegation was, how the whole thing, how it came about, and whether you achieved what you wanted to.
I have been researching this issue of drones for quite a while now and came out with a book called Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. And at the same time the book came out, we organized a drone summit in Washington, D.C., and brought a Pakistani lawyer who has been representing drone victims. And he told us a lot of horrific stories about innocent people who were being killed. And he put out a challenge to us and said that the people of Pakistan think that this is what the Americans want. And if indeed that is not what we want, we should do more to let them know. And so one idea was to go to Pakistan and participate in a march that the political leader Imran Khan was organizing to Waziristan, where the drones have been killing so many people. And we thought we would also use the time to meet with various political parties, members of the government, the military, women's organization, human rights organizations. And so I went around the country as part of my book tour, inviting people to join. And we interviewed people to see if we thought they would be good participants. Everybody had to pay their own way, so it was quite difficult for many people to go. But in the end, we had a wonderful delegation of 34 people who were committed to this issue of drone warfare. And we felt that it was extremely successful in the sense that we got a lot of international press. We were on the front pages of the Pakistani papers for about an entire week, as well as press in other countries and the United States, even mainstream press. And we managed to show the Pakistani people that there were Americans who value their lives as much as we value our own. We had two meetings with the ambassador. We were very pleased that he was willing to meet with us twice to talk about drones, since it's supposed to be a covert program, which means that most of the time government officials won't even talk about it. But he was much more open with us and willing to hear what we were concerned about and the things that we had learned before we left. And so we felt that we had a good experience in trying to put pressure on our own government via the embassy in Pakistan.
What is the next step of this project?
We have a lot of ideas. One is we met a number of very good Pakistanis who we'd like to bring to the U.S., hopefully to do some hearings at Congress and to go around the U.S. in a speaking tour. We also have some ideas of bringing some of these issues to court in the United States, and we're talking to some lawyers about this. We want to find new ways of reaching the administration after the elections are over. We have a couple of people in Congress who said once the elections are over, they're willing to join forces with us. And then we want to increase the protests that are going on at the Air Force bases and outside the CIA where these drones are being piloted. So these are some of the areas that we will explore in the coming weeks.
What I'd like to do now is if we could follow some of the chapter structure of your book, not just because of the evocative chapter headings that you have, but because that is really how people can learn more about this whole situation. Because there are legal, moral, ethical, international, so many implications of these drones. Maybe you could just answer first, what makes it actually so significant for you personally? Is there something about drones that sort of really gets to you?
Well, that's an interesting question. In some ways, yes, in some ways, no. I mean, no in the sense that I am against war and I'm for pushing my government to use negotiations and peace talks wherever possible. And I feel that war has been too much of a first resort instead of a last resort, post 9/11 especially. And in that context, drones is just one more weapon that is used to wage war. But then there are certain things about the drones that specifically are very disconcerting. One of them is that it makes it easier to get involved in conflict because it's something that can be done behind the backs of the American people since U.S. lives are not at risk. And the other is how it distances the public, the military, everybody so much more from war, being able to kill people from the luxury of an air-conditioned room and an ergonomic chair on the ground in the United States, killing people thousands of miles away, is something that I think is out of the pages of science fiction, but it's become reality. And it leads us to a place where we have what the United States has created, a PlayStation mentality towards war, as if war is some kind of video game.
Could you actually just describe what the actual scope is of the drone presence sort of worldwide right now? You know, where do they come from? Who makes them? Where do they operate? How many are there? What sort of sizes? Because one hears about drones that are as small as insects and birds. And, you know, just some idea of where they're coming from.
Today, every major weapons manufacturer is involved in some aspect of drone production because it is, as Defense Secretary Leon Panetta said, the only game in town. So whether they're producing the motors or the sensors or the missiles or one of the myriad parts of the drones, everybody from Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, General Dynamics, they're all involved. There's another company in Southern California called Aero Environment that has specialized in these miniature drones. And then there are a lot of drones that are given to the soldiers that are actually put inside their backpacks and they're launched individually by the soldiers. But the ones that I focus on in the book are the Predator and Reaper drones because they are the lethal drones.
And but it's not just an American enterprise, the drone business, right? I mean, I know that Israel, for instance, plays quite a part. And it seems from your book that there are people, countries all over the world are developing. The trend is to sort of do your own, do it yourself, right? Build your own.
Well, that's right. In fact, as you mentioned, Israel is the number one exporter of drones, exporting to 50 countries, just Israel. China is now in the act producing several variations on drones, and it's estimated now that there are 76 countries that have drones, and then there are non-state entities that have drones as well. For example, just last week there was a drone that Hezbollah used to go into Israeli airspace, and the Israelis shot down that drone. So there is a huge proliferation of drones worldwide that has been initiated by the United States.
It almost puts the nuclear proliferation treaty sort of into the shadows.
That's right, because drones are so much easier to produce, and the technology is available to either buy on the open market or to make yourself. And then we have the example of Iran that downed one of the most sophisticated spy drones that the United States has and then reverse engineered it. So, yes, it's not like nuclear technology. It's very hard to detect countries that are producing drones and very easy for them to produce them. And if they buy them as spy drones, it's quite easy to convert them to weaponized drones.
And there's no oversight. There's no oversight and international sort of scrutiny of any of these things because they're all in it.
Well, that's right. This technology has far surpassed the international rules that are in place. And that's why groups like ours and many other groups are pushing for the United Nations to take this on and to put regulations in place before it gets totally out of hand.
Can you just talk about how the U.S. sees these drones at the moment? There's legal issues.
First of all, the organizations that have access to drones, there is the military, and it's in the hands of the Joint Special Operations Command of the military. But then there is the CIA that has its own drones. And in the case of Pakistan, where the drones are most heavily used outside of the more overt war in Afghanistan, it's entirely in the hands of the CIA. Now, the CIA is not a military organization. It's a civilian organization. It's not supposed to be involved in assassinations. And in the past, when the CIA has been involved in assassinations, Congress has stepped in and reined in the CIA. Now we see Congress missing in action, I would say, done in complete secrecy without any accountability or transparency.
One of the so-called benefits of drones is that they are inexpensive, allegedly, and that they've lowered the cost of war. And I think you report a military expert saying it's a dream come true, much as what Panetta said. So is it successful in that sense? Are they really efficient things, these drones, from a military point of view?
Well, from a military point of view, if you're saying that does it help to win a war against Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, I think the proof is that we've been using these drones for over 10 years now, and we haven't won anything. In the case of Pakistan, where I just returned, people are very clear that every time there was a drone strike, it would be the best recruitment tool that the Taliban have, and that dozens of, if not hundreds of local people would want to take up arms and try to kill U.S. soldiers across the border into Afghanistan. So it only perpetuates the cycle of violence. It doesn't stop it. There's no way we can keep killing enough people when every time we kill people, it creates new enemies.
Yeah, so it's efficient but not effective, maybe.
That's right. I think that's a good way of putting it.
This is Tidings from Hazel Khan on WPKN, where Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink, is talking about drone warfare. What is it like where these anti-American attitudes are hardening? What is it like just to be a Pakistani mother or father or child?
Well, that's a good question, because so much of the discussion about drones has focused on the issue of, are they killing civilians or militants? But it's important to also look at the daily terror that people are under when they live in the areas where the drones are being used. We got a chance to talk to people directly about this when we were in Pakistan, and there's also the report that came out by Stanford University and NYU University called Living Under Drones that does a very good job of describing what life is like for people. And there we see a description of people who are oftentimes afraid to go out of their homes, afraid to send their children to school, afraid to meet in public places, afraid to attend weddings, afraid to go to funerals. It has really terrified especially the young children who hear the buzzing of the drone on a constant basis.
And then there's this other thing which I wonder if you can explain, double tap.
Right, after one drone attack and the Hellfire missile is fired, there's a second missile fired called a double tap. And oftentimes what that does is then kill the people who are running in to rescue the people who have been killed with the first missile. This is something that is totally against international law. It's considered a war crime to be attacking rescuers. And it's something that has been brought up in very harsh terms by entities within the United Nations asking the United States to justify this. And there have always been, also been, as you alluded to, attacks on gatherings like one that happened on March 17, 2011, when tribal leaders were gathering in a traditional setting called a jirga to deal with community problems, and the Hellfire missiles killed over 40 of them. And there have been reports of attacks at funerals as well.
And what struck me, my own personal association to this, was this double tap idea. But that's one of the marks also of Al-Qaeda attacks, is they attack whatever it is, and then when people rush in to rescue or whatever, that they do another attack, another that they're coordinated in that way. So it seemed to me, I don't know who learned from whom on this one, but it seemed incredibly cynical.
Right. Whoever is doing it, it is definitely a war crime and horrendous act of inhumanity.
You know, the other thing that, and here I come again from a point of view of the of what it's like to be an occupier, as in Israel, occupying the West Bank, annexing Gaza. I've often thought about what it does to the Israelis themselves. And in this case, I'm thinking about the operators of these drones. The whole video game thing, is, and you call it the pilots without a cockpit in your title. One of the things, it engenders great hatred for America, and also feeling that Americans are cowards, because those tribal men in Afghanistan, the tribal people in Afghanistan and Pakistan, they're not cowards. I mean, they don't, they show themselves with their guns. And this idea of, you know, the enemy sort of not even showing itself somehow just makes it even more egregious. I don't know. But what does it do to the American soldier, to the American operator?
I think it has a tremendous psychological impact on them. And what they're finding in studies is that there are remote-controlled soldiers who are suffering the same kind of PTSD as soldiers in the battlefield. Now, it's very hard to try to compartmentalize your life to be somebody who is killing people by daytime and then go home to your family. You're supposed to be a good husband, a good father, a member of your faith-based community. And so for many of these drone pilots, it's a very difficult thing to do, and they're showing the same kind of psychological problems.
So that brings us to maybe one of the last questions, and that is to just get into the whole idea of the moral dimension, the morality of this whole thing, of what is essentially a paradigm shift in warfare. I mean, whatever one thinks about warfare, this is a whole new way of warfare. And as you say, from boots on the ground to assassins in the air. What is it, this whole idea of a just war, and somehow not having to account for civilian deaths?
The whole idea that we can be killing people in secret and not having to account for it at all, not having to even report publicly about who was targeted, why they were targeted, I find totally against any precepts of democracy. And if we think that we want to live in a world where the rule of law applies, how can we let our government get away with this? There's no chance for people who are being targeted by drones to surrender. There's no chance for them to be tried. So I have been shocked that so many of the people who were outraged during the Bush administration's years of using indefinite detention in Guantanamo and torture and extraordinary rendition have been silenced when the Obama administration is using something that is perhaps even worse, these drone strikes. And in fact, the Obama administration, some of the legal counsel, has called the drone strikes a clean way of dealing with terrorists. And clean means that the bodies are obliterated, that you don't have the messiness of a trial, like we are seeing now, military trials or civilian trials, but it is assassinations nonetheless. And I'm hoping that with my book and the book tour and the work that we're doing to get the voices of Pakistani victims out, we'll have more people that join us in trying to stop these lethal drones.
Yeah, it's almost the equivalent of just the disappeared, right? They just disappear, literally. And therefore wiped out from the need to be accountable.
Right, and what does it say to the rest of the world that we so belittle the lives of other people? When we were in Pakistan, they said, you know, how can you get away with killing thousands of our people as if our lives didn't matter at all? As you say, just obliterated, just wiped off. We are disposable people as far as the U.S. is concerned. And, of course, this creates tremendous anger and humiliation and a sense of the United States as the uncaring hegemonic power that thinks that it can do this precisely because it has military might. Mm-hmm. But that blows back at us in the form of hatred that people feel towards us. And when they feel hatred, they try to find ways to harm us. So that's one of the reasons that this drone policy is so dangerous and so counterproductive.
And yet, if we could talk about the future of it, I mean, it looks as if the future can only become worse. Since there are no mechanisms in place to restrain for restraint. And you talked about swarms. I don't know, somehow these kinds of technologies give rise to quite colorful language, you know, swarms and the drone sphere and so on. And this whole escalation that you also talk about into, first of all, them becoming autonomous robots, which are even worse than the ones now, and sort of being part of the whole biotech, nanotech control matrix, the weaponization, all these things look like an intensification.
That's right. It's bad enough to have these pilots thousands of miles away, but what's in the works now is to not have pilots at all. So, yes, you know, something has to be done about it, and it's not going to come from our government. It's going to come from people rising up. It's going to come from people around the world rising up. It's going to come from other governments taking the U.S. to task at the United Nations. And hopefully through a combination of those kinds of pressures, we'll force our own government to start obeying international law.
So that might be a good place to just briefly mention the activism that you have reported in the book.
Yes, I think there's growing activism outside of Air Force bases. We see more and more groups getting involved in protests, getting arrested outside Air Force bases where the drones are being piloted. We're hooking up with people in Europe and other places, doing some of these things jointly. We've been organizing protests at the headquarters of companies that are making the drones. And we have been working with other groups, particularly scientists, that want to bring this issue to the to Geneva, to the arms control entities of the United Nations. So there's many different areas in which people are mobilizing and organizing, and part of that is just educating people. Unfortunately, the polls show that the American people still think that this is good policy. They don't know how counterproductive it really is. So part of our work in as organizers is really just to do more education, to get the media to cover this more, which is why the trip to Pakistan was so important, and to take this into the churches, the temples, the mosques, to really get religious leaders to talk about the moral and ethical issues around drones. So there's a lot of work for us to do.
And, you know, as you said, to also bring Pakistanis out here who've experienced drones.
Well, I think we have to say that the shooting of Malala is another example of horrendous extrajudicial attempts at murder. Mm. And whether it's an awful case like that perpetrated by the Taliban or extrajudicial killing by the United States, these things have to stop. But we also have to show that it's through the drone strikes that you're creating more extremism. In fact, we met with a young lawyer who was doing studies and speaking to people who are in the prisons because they wanted to be suicide bombers and they were caught. And she's finding that the majority of them got to that position because of these drone strikes. So drones create extremism.
Well, and they're destroying the social and economic infrastructure of the villages, family structure, the social structure, as well as the physical structure.
Right, and there's got to just be another way of dealing with the issue of the Taliban. And people we talked to in Pakistan had many ideas, but they said as long as it continues to be fought by the United States through drones, it will appear that this is a Western issue, and they have to make it their own issue, and they have to deal with Taliban themselves.
Could we end with you pointing our audience to where they can find more information from you? Because your book itself has a large, long, rich list of resources and endnotes.
Yes, I'd encourage people to read the book and then to keep up with two websites.
DronesWatch.org and CodePink.org. And where can they get your book?
They can get the book on both of those websites or from Amazon.
And the book is Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control by Madia Benjamin, with a foreword by Barbara Ehrenreich, and it's published by OR Books. So, Madia, thank you very much. I look forward very much to having our audience hear you and to become more energized and activated about this drone issue, because we need everybody to know about it.
Wonderful.
So thank you very much indeed.
That's right. Well, thank you so much for the great interview.
That was Madia Benjamin of Code Pink talking about her book on drone warfare and the numerous ways in which she and her fellow activists worldwide are attempting to end U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan and elsewhere. Tidings is heard on the second Wednesday of each month at 7:30 p.m. on WPKN 89.5 FM Bridgeport and streaming and archived at wpkn.org. This and earlier Tidings podcasts are posted on hazelkahn.com. Tidings is produced by Tony Ernst.